This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, presidential Twitter and apple pie, not, however, in the same story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, the 6th of February. Good to have you along, everybody. We begin today with case number 17-35105 in the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, State of Washington, et al. Plaintiffs appellees v. Donald J. Trump, et al. Defendants appellants. Specifically, quote, a motion for leave to file brief of technology companies and other businesses as amicus curiae in support of appellees, unquote. Unpacking that just a little bit. It's a list of 97 technology companies, starting with AdRoll, Aeris, and Airbnb, down through Y Combinator, Yelp, and Zynga. Almost all the biggies are in there. They're opposing the president's travel ban because, in a nutshell, it's really bad for their businesses. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going.
If you had to boil it down, there are two main reasons that people, or in this case, companies, file amicus briefs, says Washington University law professor Steve Legomsky.
One of the things they can do is elaborate on very specific points that the main parties couldn't elaborate on in their own briefs because of page limits.
The second reason?
They can add points that only those with their particular interests would even think of.
Points like how the travel ban is hurting the tech industry's ability to recruit workers from outside the U.S.
And for a business like ours, talent is the lifeblood.
That's Eric Dewar, an executive with Rocket Fuel, a global marketing firm. He says joining the brief sends a message.
For our clients, for our employees, for our investors, everyone needs to know, like, this is a core value for us of being inclusive and, having diversity that leads to great innovative ideas.
But can amicus briefs actually influence the court?
Oh, of course. They do.
Jane Aiken is vice dean at Georgetown University Law Center. She says a brief can remind judges of the different ways the ban impacts people and companies. But she says the fact these tech firms represent enormous economic power may not be that significant.
Technically, this is a legal decision, and it should be based on the law and what the law essentially points to as the outcome.
Aziz Huck is a law professor at the University of Chicago, who himself is filing an amicus brief today on behalf of Muslim groups. He says these briefs have become so common.
They may be less important than they used to be. When you have a case in which there's 30 or 40 amicus briefs, it's actually pretty hard to figure out which ones are important and which ones are not.
So far, only a handful of briefs have been filed against the travel ban. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Sometimes you got to go looking around for business opportunities. Sometimes they just fall in your lap. This next story is about the latter version, presidential edition. President Trump is a known fan of cable news shows. Morning Joe on MSNBC, The O'Reilly Factor on Fox News, CNN every now and then. And it has become clear that he will often tweet in direct response to what he has seen on the air, which is, as previously noted, for advertisers and groups that want to get his attention, an opportunity too good to pass up. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that one.
When the advocacy organization VoteVets.org wanted to get a message to President Trump to tell him they were unhappy with the travel ban and with plans to kill off the Affordable Care Act, they went to where they thought they'd find him and bought an ad on Morning Joe.
You want to be a legitimate president, sir? Then act like one.
It's a long way from the more typical cable news ad break.
You see them generally directed at old men and women. Because that's the nature of the television news audience traditionally.
Merrill Brown is the director of the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University. He expects cable news watchers are going to start seeing more and more issue advertising, lobbying-type advertising, the kind you might see during the Sunday news shows. It's a whole new category of ads he thinks cable news will attract.
Knowing that the president is watching, and if the president is watching, you might assume that his fellow government officials are also watching as well, just so they can get some sense of what the president is perceiving about the world.
It's a type of ad, an advertiser, that could push cable news ad rates even higher. James Finnessy is the CEO for Standard Media Index. He says as way more people have been watching Fox, MSNBC, and CNN, the networks have jacked up the cost of ads over the last quarter.
We've seen rates more than double.
VoteVets.org says it spent about $6,000 for airtime this morning, which sounds like a bargain for a chance to grab the attention of the president. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, it's been better. Not terrible, but it's been better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's today's Marketplace Depressing Economic Reality Report. About 70 million Americans are expected to retire over the next 15 to 20 years. And when you throw in all the variables that go into a good and comfortable retirement, stuff like overall economic growth, the kinds of pay people have been getting over their careers, government policies about retirement savings, and, oh yeah, human nature, we are, it's quite possible, looking at a retirement crisis the next couple of decades. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Want to ruin a good time with everyone around you? Ask if they're saving enough for retirement.
No, not the case.
Most likely not.
Well, I'm putting, you know, a little bit of my paycheck in my savings, but that usually gets depleted by my next paycheck anyway.
Melissa Nagels, Lori Mengri, Greg Jablonski, Tom Olin, they range in age from their 20s to their 50s. How much saving is enough?
I would say I take about 10% of every paycheck and I put it on saving. And so... I guess I'm on the right track.
Nope. Sorry, Giovanni Barrera, who was trying to eat his lunch peacefully in New York City. Retirement experts estimate we should be saving 15 to 17% of our income across our working lives if we want to maintain our pre-retirement standard of living. According to Fidelity, by the time we retire at age 65, we should have 11 times our annual income saved up. A lot of us are not even close.
We're on a pending crisis in retirement security.
Diane Oakley is the executive director of the National Institute on Retirement Security.
We have a lot of individuals who have nothing saved for retirement, probably about 40% of the workforce.
Oakley used Federal Reserve data to see if households were saving enough, even by conservative estimates.
We found that basically 6 out of 10 households weren't on track.
Experts say the crisis is brewing particularly among the 50s and below crowd.
We think that it's going to start within, say, about 10 years or so and just get steadily worse from that point forward.
David John is a senior policy advisor at the AARP Public Policy Institute. This retirement problem is one that a lot of developed countries are now facing, which makes you think there's a global cause involved, which there is.
Steadily growing life expectancies, so that someone who retired, say, in the 1950s, probably didn't really expect to get much out of the late 60s or early 70s. But now the odds are almost 50-50 that someone who's retiring today can live into their 90s.
Another reason we're not saving enough? We were really wrong for decades about how much enough is. In the booming market years of the 80s and 90s, people said, oh, you just need to put away 3% of your income each year. Your employer will help. Get a little Social Security and you'll be fine. Two recessions and almost a decade of sluggish economic growth have offered a reality check. We need to save more.
We've been in a low investment return environment, and that's true for both stocks and bonds. And that means that you have to save a lot more in order to accumulate the same amount that you might have accumulated under a higher return situation.
And you know, in the olden days, mom and dad moved in with the kids when they retired, says Diane Oakley.
My mother didn't want to do that, nor do I, nor do most of my brothers and sisters want to live with their kids when they retire. So we've changed the sort of standard.
So what to do? Well, when employers automatically enroll employees in retirement plans like 401ks or 403bs, it dramatically increases the chances that people will at least start to save. But only about half of employers offer retirement plans, and not all enroll their workers automatically.
And so now we are thinking about some new proposals that have come on the scene, mostly at the state level.
John Scott is with the Retirement Savings Project at Pew. So, for example, in Massachusetts, small employers often find it beyond their means to offer retirement plans. So the state is trying a system where multiple small nonprofits can share plans. Oregon, Illinois, and California are experimenting with automatically enrolling workers into a state-run retirement plan when employers don't offer one. These could reach millions of workers this year.
There's, I think, the big challenge, which is, you know, is this financially feasible for a state to pull off?
The administrative costs for programs like these that could touch every working adult in a state are daunting. And while programs like these will increase the number of people saving for retirement, experts say they don't guarantee that people will choose to save enough. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The new deadline for healthcare reform is, as President Trump said over the weekend, the end of this year, maybe early next. That's a different timetable than was offered just a week or two ago when the president was talking about a plan coming as soon as his nominee for Health and Human Services, Tom Price, was confirmed, as in maybe a couple of weeks from now. One big chunk of the healthcare industry, hospitals, sees that GOP slowdown as a lobbying win in Washington. So now from our help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at how those hospitals might use their newfound time.
The Sinai Health System in Chicago serves some of the city's poorest neighborhoods. But since the Affordable Care Act began, the hospital's rate of uninsured patients has been cut in half, and it now spends $30 million a year less on charity care.
Trust me, that hasn't gone into our salaries. We really invested that right back into community services, and behavioral health is where we made our biggest investment.
That's Sinai's Roberta Rakove. Rakove has started spending more time in Washington, and when she's there, she buttonholes people on Capitol Hill about a new unit for patients with mental health problems.
We love this unit, right? And this is a win for the patients. It's a win for the healthcare system because you're taking people out of the emergency room where they don't belong.
Like Sinai, hospitals around the nation have saved millions of dollars a year because many of their uninsured patients have now become paying customers, largely due to Medicaid expansion under the ACA. Hospital executives worry Republicans will cut back insurance coverage and that they won't get the federal help covering those uninsured, at least the way they used to before Obamacare, which would eat into their thin margins. Atul Grover with the Association of American Medical Colleges says slowing down will help hospitals make their case.
The more time we have and the more details we have on potential proposals, the more we can actually be data-driven and show them the potential impact. And that makes a big difference.
Grover says the downside to the slowdown, more time hospitals must sit with uncertainty. The upside, hospitals, which are large employers and powerful lobbyists, now know they've got longer to do their thing. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We keep using that word uncertainty, but that's really what's happening.
Uncertainty may be, but man, they make good pie. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 19 points today at 10%, 20,052. The NASDAQ gained 3 points, less than a 10%, 5663. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about 0.2%. 229.02. There are falling crude oil prices hit energy companies. Chesapeake Energy flagged 2.8%. Marathon Oil down 4% today. Food company Sysco retreated 2.5% after reporting weaker than expected revenues. Tyson Food down 3.4%. Kraft Heinz off 0.6% today. Toymaker Hasbro shot up 14% on better than expected fourth quarter profit and sales. The company said a line of dolls based on the Disney Princesses and Frozen franchises boosted results, like in my house. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. At the risk of repeating myself, and not for the first time, by the way, President Trump ran hard on the economy and how he was going to make things better for businesses in this country, especially small businesses. Handy for us, then, that we know a couple of small business owners not too far from Marketplace World headquarters. Lindsay Hollister Hefner and Sean Brennan run the Pie Hole. We've had them on the show before. They started with one shop in L.A.'s Arts District, and they have been growing ever since. So we went over the other day, sat down over a cup of coffee, and talked about what the Trump presidency might mean for them, and caught up a little bit about what's been going on since the last time we chatted.
It was really awful, I'm not going to lie.
Seriously? It was an intense year. It was good for the company. Business-wise, good. The restaurant industry, you know, third and fourth quarter as a whole didn't do great, mostly because of the election and public perception, yeah.
So is that just like nervousness and uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
And
we heard statistically people spend less in election years.
Yeah.
So we didn't, I mean, it wasn't like we took a really big hit, but we definitely noticed it.
So talk to me, since Election Day, what have you seen?
So when we opened the Pie Hole, we opened the middle of the recession, right?
Yep.
And we thrived because everybody knew what was happening. Like, they understood we're in a recession and they needed comfort food. But with this, since the inauguration, I think people just got like soup. Yeah, so the uncertainty is just killing the restaurants.
And so what are you doing? Are you just, are you putting aside money? Are you changing your budget for 17 or 18, I guess, now coming up? Or what are you doing?
We're buckling down.
Are you?
Definitely. I mean, we're making changes that any small business in our position should be making anyway, lowering costs and really focusing. But I think we're on a roller coaster ride. I feel like personally, we, with this administration, it's like we've learned that they can say one thing, but then something else is being done. So we keep using that word uncertainty, but that's really what's happening.
Right.
And so it's like we don't see the plan. We don't and then who knows whatever plan there is, if that's even going to happen.
Specifically for us, one of the big issues is labor secretary, you know, former fast food guy, right?
That's Andy Puzder, fast food guy.
That should be good.
Carl's Jr.,
right.
All of that, yeah.
That should be good for us. What's not good for us is either the perception of or the actuality of policy changes that would affect immigration that would then change the way that produce is made California.
You're skipping way down on my list of questions to ask. But since we're on that now in immigration, let's say you want to make an apple pie, right? But immigration restrictions that are coming or have been put into place do something about agriculture workers. How do you get the apples that you need to make your apple pie if farm labor in this country is reduced?
Or the cost of it goes up.
Right.
We're very concerned that produce is going to skyrocket because labor is going to be affected. This is what farmers are saying in the state right now. And if at the same time labor and commodity pricing changes in the state of California where we get most of our produce, and we can't find an alternate means in another state or from Mexico or some place to get those commodities.
So I'm terrified of having to say, oh, no, your apple pie is now going to be upwards of $40, $45 for a whole pie.
You guys make really good pies, but I don't know if I'm paying $45 for an apple pie.
Well, we put 10 whole apples into every pie, and it's all cut by hand. Our dough is rolled out and made from scratch by hand, and it costs money.
$45 for an apple pie.
Well, it's not that right now. I want to
fair enough. Totally fair. And for the record, I'm going to buy some pies on the way out of here. Every time I leave, the folks in the office say, you got to bring back pies, and I do. All of that said, though, about the caution and the uncertainty that you're feeling now, 2016 was a year where you guys grew. You expanded.
We did.
Franchised. You're in Japan now, for crying out loud.
We opened 4 stores last year.
That's a lot of growth for you guys are still a startup, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. And we're still growing.
So take me through the calculus of we're going to do this now.
We definitely decided to grow very quickly and take anything that we had and put it, you know, back into the next store and the next store. And
I think we mentioned that we had a chance to be sort of, you know, first to the market for this concept, and we wanted to take advantage of it. But also, you know, we knew that we couldn't survive on just one shop alone. We couldn't. It's too expensive in California to have a business. So we had to open more stores. We knew that.
Grow or die, right?
Grow or die.
Spitball 2017 for me.
Lots of travel.
Lots of travel. Right? In the franchising thing, sure.
Yeah.
We definitely have 5 shops that have leases signed.
Wow.
So
that's huge for you. In 1 year, you're going to open 5 shops?
And there'll probably be more.
All right. Well, let's go buy some pies. Ended up, in case you're curious, trying their new Taking Care of Business pie. It's banana, peanut butter, and bacon. Very good, I'm told. I didn't have any. Also, Earl Grey and Mexican chocolate pies as well. We're going to follow up with Lindsay and Sean in a couple of months. In the meanwhile, though, we're going to leave you with this. A piece of tape from the cutting room floor, a peek inside the mind of a small business person. So there was a large milk disaster right back there. So I'm going to let somebody...
That costs $10.
Well, right, because it's like, you know...
You heard milk hitting the ground. I heard change.
All right, let's talk mapping apps for a minute here, shall we? In particular, mapping apps when you're driving, because a lot of people couldn't get anywhere if their phones didn't tell them where to go or would get stuck in traffic jams they could otherwise avoid because their phones can pick out a shortcut. That dependence can be scary, though, because there is some pretty vital information that doesn't show up. Marketplace's Jed Kim reports now on the efforts to include railroad crossing data in your map app.
On the one hand, it's hard to see how the driver of the truck could make such an obvious mistake. The railroad crossing at 5th and Rice in Oxnard, California is pretty clearly labeled. There's a gate arm, lots of signs. But it was early that day, nearly 2 years ago, still dark, when the crash happened. Rob Malloy, who's with the National Transportation Safety Board, says the driver's attention wasn't totally on the road, and he missed his turn.
Because of the way the signal was laid out, because he was fatigued, he accidentally turned onto the railroad tracks.
The mapping app on his phone hadn't shown any tracks nearby. The truck got stuck and the driver abandoned it, he said, to get help. A commuter train, unable to stop, crashed into it and derailed, killing the engineer and injuring dozens. It's because of this accident that last December, the NTSB issued a safety recommendation asking tech companies to include the locations of railroad crossings in their mapping apps and to warn drivers when they're approaching one. It's not a new request. Sarah Feinberg is the former head of the Federal Railroad Administration.
Back in the spring of 2015, I started lobbying these tech companies to take this railroad crossing data that we have and please integrate it into your mapping applications.
The FRA has a database of the more than 200,000 crossings in the country. Feinberg says a lot of work's gone into making sure the data's accurate because she says a lot's at stake.
There are 200 people a year that are killed at railroad crossings. If we can alert them and let them know that they're approaching a railroad crossing, we could save dozens and dozens of lives every year.
They've been making the database available to mapping companies, but...
In 500 feet, turn right onto South Rice Avenue.
As I roll up to the very intersection in Oxnard where the deadly crash occurred, there's still no sign of the crossing on my apps. Not on Google Maps.
Turn right onto East 5th Street.
Nor on Apple Maps.
Turn right onto East 5th Street.
As I comply, it's not totally inconceivable that I could have made the same mistake. My apps just tell me to turn right. The tracks do kind of look like a road. As to why the tech companies haven't incorporated the crossing data yet, it's not clear. I contacted Apple and Google, and they either didn't respond or wouldn't give an interview on the record. Experts in the field say there are a variety of reasons, though. Christian Manassa is CEO of Mobius Logic. He's studied driver safety and technology, and he says getting the data into the applications is relatively simple. It's developing and testing that takes time.
The real effort is really investigating how to make it interact with the user in a safe way.
You've really got to get the visual cues correct. Make it clear without being a distraction.
Yeah, you don't want to be liable for giving me a warning that caused me to hit a train, as opposed to me focusing on the road and noticing the train passing by.
Another reason it may be taking a while is that the company's priority is getting their maps ready for use by self-driving cars. But Michael Yule with consulting company McKinsey says those cars will need to know where the crossings are too.
Especially if there's a railroad crossing that has had issues in the past with cars being hit.
One company has begun offering railroad warnings on its new GPS devices. I talked with a spokesman for Garmin. He says it's part of its business model to offer the latest safety features. And right now, at least in this case, it's got a competitive edge. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am going to give you the name of a company and you're going to say, wait, Kai, why are you telling us this? Here goes. New Century Financial. Ring any bells? Yeah, I didn't think so. Here's why it matters. 10 years ago tomorrow, New Century, which was at the time a key player in the subprime mortgage market. Yeah, you know where I'm going now, right? 10 years ago tomorrow, they announced they were going to have to restate earnings for almost all of the prior year because a whole mess of their subprime mortgages had started to fail. You want to look for a start to the financial crisis? Tomorrow, 10 years ago? That was pretty much it. All right, one day down, four to go. That's it for a Monday. The Dow off 19 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ gained 3 points, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 off 4 points. About 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.